T.J. Abraham says he only remembers bits and pieces of his life. He doesn't remember the birth of his daughter, for example, or his wedding. He told the New York Times recently, it's like when you get drunk and wake up and wonder, what the hell? And he gets that all the time these days. Abraham is a physician in Western Pennsylvania, or was a physician, I guess. He's only 42, but not so long ago, he had to retire from his practice when he was diagnosed with neurodegenerative dementia. It's a condition caused by damage to the brain. In Abraham's case, caused by football. He was a lineman in high school and in college. When you get hit in football, hit hard, they sometimes refer to it as getting your bell rung. And Dr. Abraham said over the years, he's had his bell rung like 70 times. He told us about a drill they used to run in practice. They called it the bull in the ring.
You would have a circle of boys on the outside, and they would put one guy in the middle, tell him to chop his feet, so he'd be, you know, running hard in place. He would blow his whistle. And then you would decide the guy in the middle, whoever you would go at.
One.
Helmet to helmet, full speed.
Two. Yeah. Oh.
Try to annihilate him, knock him over.
Three. Two.
Hurt him, do whatever.
Four.
It's a rush. I was a big, strong guy. I worked out hard. You know, I would get excited when I'd hear those pads crack. I was never scared. I was never like, oh my gosh, I'm going to get hurt. Bull in the ring, I would chop my feet and go full speed at that next person, head to head, helmet to helmet, and didn't think twice about it. I think off the field, I'm a gentle giant. I'm a big teddy bear. But it was like a switch turned on when I got on that football field.
Describe what it's like, the actual physical sensation of, quote, getting your belt rung.
You know, I know they show the on cartoons when someone collides, they show stars and, yeah, you know, symbols. It's kind of the same thing you do. You see flashes of light. I remember seeing all black. I remember seeing the sky purple, the sky orange, just, you know, for a couple seconds, a minute. Or just downright nauseous with a headache and not really knowing where I'm at, what I was doing. Just kind of dazed and confused.
If you said something, if you complained back then, what was the reaction you'd get?
Don't be a sissy. Don't be a P-U-S-S-Y. Suck it up. Get back in there. Sit a play out. You want to show them that you were tough. And, you know, again, when you get your bell ring so many times and you're told you're okay, get back in, you believe it. I mean, just like now, the doctor's told me what has happened to me. I believe them. Then, you know, a trainer or a coach says, you're okay, get back in. You do. You don't know any different.
T.J. Abraham. He's been telling his story lately as a cautionary tale. Earlier this month, he testified before lawmakers in New York State considering a bill that would ban tackle football for those 12 or younger. Today in the program, we're talking about the costs and risks of football and other contact sports, not to mention what seems like a culture of violence in games like these. We're coming to learn more and more about the effects of the repeated hits that come along with this game. But what are you going to do about it? I mean, it's football. Abraham said it himself, even going through what he's gone through, he still loves, that's the word he used, still loves football.
Despite my life turning out the way it did, I still do not hate football. when you look at football for me as a little boy, I think it definitely taught me teamwork and, you know, determination and hard work. I do believe in my heart that, you know, I think even as a physician, I don't know if I would have been able to get through all the years of med school and residency if I didn't have that football background.
Wow.
I think it taught me organization. It definitely taught me hard work and team building. It taught me how to fine tune my skills. Is it bittersweet? Absolutely. It's hard to accept when you know you played a sport you loved and now you see the end result 20 some years later.
TJ Abraham, why did you become a doctor?
I wanted to help people. I think from a young age, you know, I'm 42. So, you know, I grew up in the age of ER and Doogie Howser, and
right.
I was fascinated by it. And I've always liked science, and I've always had a weird fascination with blood and guts and gore. Things like that never bothered me. So I think the fact is I've always been a people pleaser, a helper. I've always liked to help people. So I think, you know, when I saw what, you know, like ER was all about, and I saw Doogie Howser, and I my parents tell me from a young age, I always said I wanted to be a physician.
Do you remember, not sure if you can pinpoint an actual moment itself, because it seems like this was pretty gradual, but it seems like if I have the story right, doctor, that it was something like 7 years ago, things started to change or you started to notice things. Can you sort of take me through when you first start to detect
something? I'm going to be honest with you. I don't think at the time I had a clue what the hell was going on.
Yeah.
You know, and it's fine. I mean, it's okay. I mean, I think now when I talk to people, friends, family, loved ones, they've kind of helped me rewind and kind of go back and look in hindsight. And then it's kind of like it jogs my memory and I'm like, yep, I get that. Yep, I kind of remember that. Or no, I don't remember that, but I can see how that happened. And, you know, the thing I think breaks my heart the most is, you know, about 2-3 years ago, my wife had said, you know, I just feel like you're not the guy I married. You were this big, warm and fuzzy, big teddy bear, loving, calm, patient, understanding, and like you changed. And at the time, I blamed it on a lot that was going on in my life, you know, working crazy hours as an obstetrician, building a new house, getting married, merging practices. You know, I had a lot on my plate. So I'll be honest, the behavior stuff and the personality changes, I don't think I had a grasp of what was going on until recently. I mean, I had a very good medical team that kind of helped me put the pieces back together. Also talking to past friends, family, girlfriends, you know, just to paint a picture of who I was. Because I'll be honest, I think in this last year and a half, I really forgot who TJ was before all of this started to happen. From what I understand, you know, like I would call my parents in Pittsburgh and I would talk to them. And then they would say something and it would set me off, I guess. I would just hang up. I wouldn't talk to them. But more than just that, you know, it was like isolation. Like friends from college and high school would call me. They would text me. Wouldn't call them back. Or we'd have a family get together and I'd kind of find myself in the bathroom, just hiding out, isolating. You know, certain things that behaviors like being manic in a way, like overspending, overbuying, overeating, or you name it. It was very bizarre for me. Things that, and again, at the time, I felt like I was on autopilot. I felt like I was just on autopilot. That's kind of, for the way I see it now, is that's kind of where everything started with me. I definitely think in the last 3 years is where my memory started to go. Because through investigation, I coached high school football and, I think it was last summer or the summer before that. It may have been the summer right after I realized what was going on and I had been hospitalized. I was going through my phone and I saw a photo album and it was labeled, the name of the team that I had coached. And I was like, what's this? I don't have any pictures of the boys. I'm like, this is weird. I opened it up and it was a football place. And it hit me. And I said, oh my gosh, I didn't remember the place. I was struggling. I remember coming home and being so frustrated because even the coaches and, you know, the players would tease me like, coach, you sure you're a doctor? You sure you played football, man? What the heck's going on? Like, and I would laugh it off and joke, but it was seriously obviously bothersome enough that I made a cheat sheet on my phone. you know, and a guy who played football all his life with a memory like no other, being a physician, I shouldn't have been struggling with that.
Yeah.
That's kind of where I started it. And then I realized, and I also found other ways to start compensating. I was making notes everywhere to remember appointments and, you know, meetings and grocery lists and all kind of things that I never had to do before. You know, I had a life where I would be scheduled to be at the hospital for a 24-hour call, maybe have 12 surgeries scheduled for the day, five or six ladies in labor, and I remembered it all. Didn't have to use a cheat sheet. Didn't have to use yellow sticky notes or a notepad in my phone. And I guess as I look back, I was doing it for a couple years and didn't even realize it. So somehow I was compensating on my own and figuring out how to cheat and get by. You know, and then patients, you know, I'd be counseling them in the room about procedures or diseases, and I'd have trouble finding the right words. Like, I knew what I wanted to say, but I couldn't get it out. Like, simple things, you know, or things like I knew the back of my hand, like a surgery that I should be able to do with my eyes closed. I was having trouble explaining it to them. And then it got to the point where towards the very, very end, I actually had one surgery I had to go to the bathroom and scrub out because I couldn't remember how to finish the case.
In the back of your mind, and at least in those early days, was there ever a moment when you suspected that this may have been a result of your days playing football?
Absolutely not. I blamed everything on the stress of my life, my job. You know, we had some problems when we built our new home, so we had a lot of stress with construction, the job. You know, if someone would have told me 7 years ago, hey TJ, this is due to football, I would have said, what are you talking about? What do you mean it's due to football? What do you mean? What happened?
It seems like you got to a point where you were like, something's wrong. Like something seriously wrong. What was that point?
So where I hit rock bottom was that I started the behavior changes, you know.
Yeah.
I could start to tell that I was really affecting people that I loved and cared about, hurting people, whether it be words or actions or all the above. And again, when you look back and you realize who you were and you see that this is totally uncharacteristic of you and you have no idea why, that for me was a driving force, I think, for hitting rock bottom, because more and more kept popping up. And then the thing that I think I hid was my memory. So when I one day remembered that, okay, you're struggling to remember how to take care of your patients. You're not remembering faces. You're not remembering, you know, you go on your phone and you find three new apps for medication dosing and you're thinking, I'm 40 years old. Why don't I remember these doses? What is wrong? You know, then you start being, for better lack of words, accused of behaviors and told that you've said this and said that. And you're thinking to yourself, why don't I remember this? How can this be? Who did I hurt? What did I do? What did I say? It was too much. I'll be honest, I was suicidal. I didn't want to live because I was scared. I didn't know it was wrong. And I think the one thing that bothered me the most was there were days that I'd go to bed and say, I'm going to call a doctor in the morning, or I'm going to meet with someone. I'd wake up the next morning and forget. And you know, it was tough too, because, you know, my wife would tell me, geez, TJ, I told you I had to work today, or I told you you were supposed to pick up the kids, and I'd get angry. I'd get so frustrated. Like, no, you didn't. No, you didn't. And, you know, now I look back and think, yeah, she probably did. She probably did. So I guess maybe that was me being defensive or scared. But yeah, I think when you put all the behavior and the hurt and the uncharacteristic behavior, so I guess subconsciously I realized I knew who I was deep down inside, and I could feel the changes and I could tell that my memory or something was wrong. I mean, I think the best way I could describe it, I felt like I was losing my mind, literally. And I checked myself into a hospital, and it was a tough beginning. And I was fortunate that I had a few doctors who really paid attention to my life, that I played football. They reached out to people from my past, and it helped them paint a picture of who I was and then how I changed.
As you understand it, what happened? What's going on in your brain?
So they wanted to make sure that it was a true brain injury or a true neurodegenerative brain disease. So, you know, obviously I've been worked up all the way. I mean, they checked my heart, my lungs. They did a spinal tap. They did a bunch of blood work to make sure I didn't have any infections. So what they did was they went and looked at every risk factor for what's going on with me. And the only risk factor I've had is repetitive hits to my head. And it's interesting because one of the things that was concerning was is before my wedding, I had a fall in 2013. So a lot of people are like, well, maybe that fall is what did it. And again, I thought, well, maybe, you know, but I had no deficits immediately after that fall. I mean, it took, you know, 7 years and, but I do understand that this disease is not something that comes on right away. It's later in life. And, I had a good friend of mine that same partner that I worked with that told me that I was getting slow, you know, operating, said to me, did you ever look back at your medical records, TJ? Did you ever look at them from when you fell? And I said, you know, no, I didn't. So I got the records and I read them and I was sick to my stomach because I had an MRI done in 13 and it showed that I had a, much smaller than normal or what they called, atrophied hippocampus, which is your memory center. And I knew as a physician, like that didn't happen acutely from a fall. Like something was already going on there.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think, and I'll be honest, and I'm not angry at anyone. I think at the time I was just getting ready to get married. People were trying to get me back to work. So I think everyone kind of, hey, he's doing normal. He's doing okay now. He's not complaining of anything. Let's get him moving. And I respect that. I'm not upset about that, but cause I don't really know if I knew that my hippocampus was atrophied in 2013, if it would have changed much. Cause I mean, there's not much you're going to do.
Yeah.
But when I look back, obviously I think, and it all makes sense now because that hippocampus was found in 13 and kind of that's when all my changes started.
I want to ask you about, you testified before the New York State Assembly recently, and I just wanted to ask, what was the reaction? And then what I mean by that is in this sense, like you've got the industry itself, you've got college football, I'm thinking of the NFL, I'm just thinking about Little League football, how ingrained it is in some cultures, football, most cultures in this country. So there had to have been a kind of skeptical reaction in some way. I mean, they certainly felt badly that you had gone through this, but I'm wondering what was the reaction that you were getting from people?
So in the room itself, all the industry, so all the Pop Warner people, they had already left. They went first and left.
That's interesting.
But, yeah, it was interesting. But the people that were in there, I actually got a very warm reception. I mean, I got a lot of handshakes and hugs when I was done. And the two chairmen that were there, one was very receptive. One started off skeptical, but once I answered his questions, he quickly, I feel like, changed his tune. But I really didn't have a negative response in that room. You know, there was a couple of people on Twitter that made some goofy comments. Like, I feel like I read somewhere that one guy was like, well, you're a doctor. How did you not know better? Well, when I was playing, you know, high school and college football, I wasn't a doctor. So, yeah. You know, that was just a dumb comment.
Yeah.
But I didn't really have anybody skeptical there. I was glad, you know, I didn't want to have to, cause I was worried I would have to, you know, I didn't want to have to argue. I was just there to tell my story.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was just hoping it would make an impact. I really did.
I want to ask you about the limitations, the realistic limitations we should be thinking about for football, because I assume you may be thinking to just outright ban football is probably not realistic, at least not right now.
I mean, I think for children it is. I mean, I don't think a five-year-old needs to play tackle football because, number one, I don't know if you've ever watched a kid football game. They don't really tackle anyways. Like, they bump into each other and fall down. I believe that high school is probably a good age to start tackle. And the reason I say that is, you know, as a physician, I look at brain development and, even though I know that our brains are trying to always develop and trying to, you know, if they get damaged, they try to improve and heal. You know, I think right around that pre-puberty, puberty time is really when you get all that brain development. So I think if you can limit the exposure to hits early on and still let them play football, teach them their position, flag football, you know, let them learn the team, you know, the team skills, the organization, all the stuff that football teaches you minus the hitting. Mm-hmm. So I don't think that banning, you know, young kids from hitting is too far off. Do I think that we'll ever get rid of football in college or professional? No.
I read a quote from a representative of the organization USA Football about this law that they're considering in New York. And this person said that parents don't want the government telling them when their kids can play football. And I wondered what you thought about that. Just, is this a thing that you leave up to the discretion of parents, or should there? I mean, clearly you think there should be a law for kids, for when they're really young. But like, where is the boundary here when it should, the law should step in, and when should it just be common sense for parents?
Obviously, there's a lot that went on with me. And I have loved ones who don't understand, whether it be they don't want to understand or don't care to understand or don't want to listen. There's my own parents who I think, you know, they blame themselves, you know, and then on one hand, they're upset and they understand, but in the other sense, they're in denial because they don't understand the facts. So I guess what I'm getting at is that if you don't understand the facts and you don't have that medical knowledge or even a glimpse of it, or even if you can't understand the common sense part of it, I think you need someone who does understand the facts to make those rules.
Do you think are we all to blame in some way that we love the hit? We love the athleticism. We love the grace that you see in an athlete performing well. But we like the violence too. And so, do you think on some level the culture is to blame? We're to blame.
Yeah, I don't like the word blame because, you know, I think, you know, and I say this for me because I, you know, I think, you know, when you go through grief or you go through loss, you know, there's stages of grief and loss, and you want to blame someone. You want to be angry at someone.
Yeah.
Yes, I think we're all guilty of something, but I think what it comes down to is I was that guy that was into the hit, loved the hit, loved the game. But I think until it either hits home or happens to you, or someone presents the right facts, they're just never going to get it. And I think there are a lot of guys out there that have played football or other contact sports that now are on the other side. When I say other side, now see it. Mm-hmm. And I think probably education and making the public aware of what could possibly happen is probably how it's going to have to happen. But what I find interesting, and I didn't see the movie Concussion when I was going through all this until after, and I watched it, and it's interesting because there are people that, you know, they're diehard Steeler fans. They love the Pittsburgh Steelers.
Yeah.
And they knew what happened to those guys, but they can't make the correlation that the sport they love is what's ruined and hurt these people. You know, you'll hear people say, oh my God, yeah, you know, Mike Webster died. He had CTE. Oh my God, that's so bad. And then the next breath, let's go Steelers. Let's go, you know, that's the problem. I don't think people are educated. They don't understand.
The New York Times article said this, that you are intent on coming to terms with your new reality.
A couple weeks ago, I had met with my physician. And there's a couple of things that had changed with my health in terms of my brain. And, you know, he looked at me and he had said, you know, I know that we had talked about this in the past. He's like, but TJ, I truly believe more than anything, that this is neurodegenerative. There's no cure right now and it's only going to get worse. And I need for you to remain positive, but I need you to just live in the moment and enjoy every day. And again, I've had a year and a half to accept this. It's not easy. I do have my good days. I have my bad days. I cry. I get angry. But, you know, I have a wife and two kids that I have to try to remain the best I can for. And if I only have another couple months before things really drastically change, then that's just what it is. And I want to know that I'm going out doing everything I possibly could to be the best dad and best husband I can for however long I have of me being me. So when I got asked to do that interview and to speak out, I said, absolutely. I said, because my time is limited and if I can help and reach out to some families and save someone or a bunch of people from going through this, I'm going to do it. Cause I can't take care. I can't save moms and babies anymore. I can't do that anymore. I can't fix myself. There's nothing I can do right now. But I said, well, you know what? You're still a physician and you can still speak pretty well and you might as well do this while you can still make sense and you're not a bumbling idiot on there, you know? So, I know where I'm headed. I know what the end result of this is, but I have to remain positive. There's nothing else I can do. I can't change it.
T.J. Abraham, thank you very much for taking the time.
You're welcome. You're very welcome.
That's Dr. T.J. Abraham. He joined us from Erie, Pennsylvania. Today in the program, we're talking about the questions and the risks of playing football. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
With KUER's mobile app, you can listen to our live programming stream, enjoy podcasts like Radio West and Preach, browse local news, and access our 24/7 streams of BBC World Service and classical music. You can also use the new Station Finder tool to locate the KUER radio frequency that's closest to you. And if you have CarPlay in your vehicle, our app is now compatible. The KUER mobile app is available for iPhone and Android wherever you get your apps.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the costs and the risks of playing football. New research from Boston University's medical school has found it's not just the big hits we should be worried about, not just the ones that look brutal and cause concussions, but it's the single hits repeated over and over in the course of a season that may have a more lasting impact. But football, of course, is deeply embedded in our culture, so it's difficult to step away. Take the case of Judge Memorial Catholic High School. Back in September, the head football coach at Judge, Will Haas, had a problem. His team was scheduled to play Morgan High School that Friday night, but 20 of his team's 54 players were hurt. And three of them, all linemen like T.J. Abraham, had recently suffered concussions. So we talked to the principal, and they made a call that doesn't happen all that much in sports. They decided not to play the game. They forfeited. Now, it came at a cost. Literally, they had to pay a fine from the state's High School Activities Association. And they did resume the season the next week. But for all the talk of doing something about injuries in sports, you don't often find institutions making a decision like this. So we wanted to hear about it. Joining us on the program is the principal of Judge Memorial Catholic High School, Patrick Lambert. Just by way of his qualifications, we should also point out he's a former coach himself, taught lacrosse and coached lacrosse for a number of years. And Patrick Lambert, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Well, thank you so much for having me on the show.
Also with us today is Amy Donaldson. She's a staff writer at the Deseret News. She's been covering high school sports in Utah for, what is it, 20 years? Is it 20 years?
It is indeed, yes.
Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Patrick Lambert, I want to begin with you. And just tell me basically about the decision you made to forfeit that game. And like at the moment, did you think this is a big deal that we're doing this? Or, I mean, what were you thinking?
Well, I guess if our entire focus is on student safety and student wellness, that it probably just puts you into the moment and makes you realize that we need to make decisions that is best for the kids right in front of us. So the greater community, we could focus on that at a later time, but first and foremost, we need to focus on these children that are right in front of us. And so we had 54 players to start the season, and by the midway through the season, we were down to about 30 healthy children ready to go out there and play. And I think we've got a unique sport with football in that if you are outmatched size-wise, weight-wise, that kids
which
are,
you probably were
which
with Morgan,
we were
right?
At that point. Yeah, and yeah. So we had a number of our juniors and seniors that were out, and we were going to likely have to put three freshmen out there against the soon-to-be state champions, Morgan High School. And so Will Haas called our athletic director and said, I'm just really concerned about this. I'm concerned about putting, you know, three 14-year-olds out there in the middle of a very violent game. And I think we need to reconsider this. And so the three of us got together, we talked about it and said, listen, it's just not worth it to put these kids out and really change their experience and likely their love for the game if we were to put them into any type of danger. So we made the decision to cancel the game.
Did you think about it that you were making, like, it sounds like it's pretty circumstantial, like, and it's common sense. But I wonder, did you think about it as you were sort of working this through that it was making some kind of a statement or that it was something bigger than just a decision to call a game?
I recognized that in the public eye, it would be taken a certain way. Yeah. And I did think that we don't want to let down a greater school community. We want to be able to have that community event on a Friday night. It's the biggest event we have throughout the entire school year, those 5 to 6 home games. And they are incredible when it comes to morale boosting, and they are just being able to keep those alumni connections and the spirit of the school. So I knew that would be a challenge, and one that I would want to get plenty of messaging out and be able to have some alternatives of, you know, some other ideas that we could maybe throw forward to have community events in place of. But overall, the reaction was very positive. And I was actually kind of surprised by the amount of positivity of putting with the decision to put students first. And so overall, I feel like it validated what we were doing.
But it sounds like part of you was kind of bracing yourself for something more negative.
Oh, absolutely.
Maybe. Yeah.
Absolutely. And we're a private school, so no one's forced to come through our doors. And yeah. So with that, we're always trying to put our best foot forward. And we knew that there would be, a negative feel of, wow, are they not able to put a team out there to play on a Friday night for the first time in Judge's history that I know of, yeah, where a game has been canceled.
Yeah. Amy Donaldson, how do you see this story? Like, what did you think is big about this story, or significant or important?
Well, what's significant about it is that I don't think people understand how much the financial cost to not having the game. And I don't know if this was a home game for you guys.
It was.
So this funds a lot of the other things the students do. And it's not just in the activities funds, but you have a lot of booster club type organizations, cheerleaders, they're selling things, you know, trying to make money piggyback off of this community event. And my stepson went to Judge and he played football his senior year. So I know there's not a seat to be had. It's a packed house.
Yep.
And there's all kinds of causes and things you can contribute to. So that's the most significant thing to me, is that it's a huge financial sacrifice. But I would say this is not the first time that it's happened in high school sports. I was at a game where I couldn't believe a team had taken the field with a number of kids who were going to get annihilated, because it was near the end of the season. This is what happens. Football is definitely a war of attrition. And they didn't come out for the second half. They just said, we just can't do this to our kids. And but I do think football is such it's a culture that one of the reasons you have trouble addressing this issue is because there's this idea that you get rewarded for playing hurt. You're a warrior. You're supposed to go out there bleeding and concussed and, bones sticking out. Tape me up, coach. Put me back in. And so in Will making that call to you is probably the most surprising thing for me, because I've thought this decision cannot be a coach's decision, because coaches are the guys who are like, follow me into battle. We're going down.
Yeah.
So
what do you think about that? That's interesting. I mean, he wasn't trying to insulate himself from the response necessarily, but I mean, what do you make of that?
And I think you've got a coach that is confident. He is recognizing that he's putting the kids first, and it's not about his lifelong record when it comes to, overall wins and losses. So I think we have at times a win at any cost mentality, and he breaks from that, and he's a person first type of coach. And I, when we look at financial costs and things like that, that certainly comes into play. And I'm glad that our focus was on student wellness first and foremost.
And I'll say also, I have a big project that's coming out next weekend in the Deseret News about who's coaching our kids and are they qualified to do so. And I checked your coach, and he's actually done one of the few who's done all of the training required. And that may be one of the reasons why he had the confidence to go to his principal, because he's done concussion protocol training every single year he's been a head coach. And every school does not have that guy leading their teams.
It's interesting that, Amy, you're talking about the fact that a lot of organizations within the school are trying to move merch on the night of football games.
We all ride the coattails of football.
Well, so it's interesting. So you build a kind of – there's a lot built around the game.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how hard would that be to even change that or restructure something like that?
Well, it's the biggest community event of the year for us.
For sure. I mean, that you get every – it's hard to find a seat, right?
Yes.
Right. So, I mean, we do have other sports that also play 7 o'clock games throughout the week, but there is something about the limited number of games that also draw a big crowd and just the consistency of when it occurs. So,
hey, and it's about Friday night, right?
You know,
this is what we do in this country.
Go to any community. Go to the most rural, far-flung community, and everybody's there. People who don't have kids at the school. If I go to a basketball game, I'm mostly going to see other basketball parents or students, you know, people who have some connection to that game or that contest. But you go to a football game, and you might see people who have no connection. They just want to see football. My husband, when we go on vacation, loves to go see other high school football games.
Wow, is that right?
He played high school football. But yeah, it's something about the community. And schools will tell you that the reason they invest so heavily in this is it does bring the community together, and it brings boosters out in a way that no other sport has been able to do.
The first year I was a principal, I was given the advice of, if you want to control the climate in the hallways or to improve the climate in the hallways, invest in your football team. Hmm. That was day one.
Wait, what does that mean? What does that mean?
So there is a sense of pride that comes with a team that is successful in the hallway that carries over into the hallways of a positivity, of a real rebirth each year, just starts off on such a great note, which then that carries over into the fall and the spring. But it is the most impactful sport in overall school climate.
Amy, that gets us to something that you've written a lot about, and that is kind of the and this is one of the things we asked our listeners to respond to some questions about this. One of them, of course, is, and we'll get to this a bit later, would you let your kid play football? Mm-hmm. Because most said no, like significantly so. And I'm guessing most of them mean it, but I wonder sometimes if they mean it when it comes right down to it. But one of the things you've written a lot about is that one listener said that there was this sense of brotherhood and camaraderie. And you hear that a lot. It teaches discipline. It teaches teamwork. And this is something you yourself have written about playing
Absolutely.
Basketball. Like, mm-hmm. you had a good coach and a not so good coach. The good one taught you about the teamwork part. So it seems like that's the good part. But then there's the other part of this. So we've got the two parts that are playing around, I guess, in sports.
The thing I think that's unique about football is it teaches a sacrifice for your teammate that's really hard to find in other sports. I mean, you can set a pick in basketball, but it's nothing like laying down a great block for a running back.
Because you're laying your body on the line.
Because you're physically making a sacrifice of your body, yeah. right? And so there's really not another sport like it. But can you learn sacrifice and hard work and discipline? You can learn that, I think, in the band. Right? There's something to be said for, you know, if you're a singer, moderating, and you don't need to be the soloist every time. Sometimes you're the backup singer or you're part of a group. Mm. So there are all kinds of ways to teach this. But I do think there are certain kids, and I was probably one of them, who really crave the physicality of a game like football. And so I don't think that it's like something you should get rid of. I just hate that it sucks up all the oxygen in the room, and there's no conversation about even how much risk women are at.
Yeah.
There's not even studies. You look at all these TBI studies, they're all about men's brains.
Yeah.
And there's nothing that looks at Megan Rapinoe talked about this and Michelle Akers. They've agreed to donate their brains to science. But where are the studies about the impact on women and women's brains? You know, why do girls basketball players and girls soccer players, they actually have a higher incident of concussion than football players do?
Why do you think that is?
For a lot of reasons. And I'd say first and foremost is they have a lower quality of coaching. So what you need to be a girls basketball coach, I would, you know, just suppose in my travels in 20 years, is a lot less than what you need to be a football coach. And there's a lot less pressure. You can have a bad women's basketball coach stay in place forever, and if you're a football coach who can't win games, whether you're the best guy on the planet or not, you're not going to keep that job very long. And the average lifespan of a coach right now in high school football is 5 years, and that was not the case when I started. And some of that is all of these different changes and demands, and it's a real cultural shift asking people to ask for help when they're hurt. Girls don't have any trouble saying, hey, I hit my head and I don't feel good and I want to come out of the game. But I would say that until 2011.
But boys are culturally conditioned not to.
Yeah. Oh, and I had Provo High actually used a helmet that sent information to their medical team. And I interviewed a kid who got concussed and was removed from practices and games until he got a doctor's note. And I talked to him about it, and he said, it was actually a great relief to me not to have to tell my coach I was hurt. That they came out and told my coach I'd had a concussion because I didn't feel good, but I don't want to be called the guy who can't stay in there and take it.
So is this – what is this? Is this a culture of violence? Is it culture of masculinity? Like if you put your finger on it, is it a lot of all of that?
I mean, you could say it's masculinity, but like you have 300 high school girls playing football right now.
Yeah.
So I don't – I think what it is – I love boxing. I love MMA. So I think – is it violent? For sure it's violent. But it's controlled violence. There's a discipline aspect to it. It's not just going out into the street and getting a fight with people or – you know, a lot of people will say, I love the hitting of it. I love – and what you love about that is this – it's the warrior aspect of it. Mm-hmm. And women are just as – in love with that feeling as men are. It's just that we don't have the opportunities to sort of embrace that fullness of our personalities, even to this day. But I think that until you address that warrior mentality and say, you have this problem with veterans. I'm in a veterans group. Same issue. There's something wrong with you if you can't handle hit after hit after hit and just keep going.
And I would say the physicality portion of the game, I think, does create a great sense of camaraderie. And so I completely understand how young men and women are excited about being together on that, you know, on that night in front of that crowd under those lights. And they're all laying it out on the line together. And so I think what it comes down to is, okay, what are our next steps to be innovative and try to be able to create an environment where if a child is injured that he can, you know, feel, you know, comfortable coming forward to the coach, and the coach will be supportive. And so,
yeah, but wait, it sounds like you're conceding that we can't get the violence out of it. We can't get the contact out of it. That's not going to happen.
I'll concede that as well. Huh.
It's a different sport if you take that mentality out of it. That's what we love about football.
But we don't love flag football.
No.
As we look at innovations, I am in full support of flag football up through the eighth grade and being able to get kids through, you know, to that point, still loving the game, the movement, all of the skills besides the tackling. And so when I'm listening to TJ Abraham talk about Bull in the Ring drills that he was doing 20 some years ago, I can relate to that and experience that as well. And
yeah.
There was a thrill that was occurring during that time. There was a rush. But tackling drills now have evolved and morphed, and the amount of contact and practices now has decreased. And I think it takes responsible coaches like Judge Memorial's coach, Will Haas, being able to say, all right, we're not going to be throwing kids in the middle of a circle and everyone try to cream them. Instead, let's work on these new types of tackling drills. Let's do this. And then when it comes to our training support, if you look at the sidelines of most high schools now, and especially, and I would say for us, we have a great partnership with the University of Utah that supports our training staff, full-time professional trainers there, concussion protocols that are now in place that we do pre-season concussion protocols. We now have counseling support set up for our students if they do experience a concussion, so that our counselors at the school are meeting with each of their teachers to try to set up a plan to help getting them back on pace. So I think we're taking it very seriously, and we need to.
I should mention that we asked listeners, I was mentioning before, there are a number of questions, a few questions anyway. Would they let their kids play tackle football? We asked on a number of social media platforms, and the vast majority in the 90s, I think it was 95%, said they wouldn't let their kids play tackle football. There were like 300 responses. Other five, of course, said yes. And I'm wondering what you think about that, the idea that when it comes right down to it, as you're starting to assess risk, mm-hmm. and this gets us to the question of what is the future of football? We know it's in decline to some degree, even in places like Texas, for example. So what do you make of that?
Well, it's in decline at the lower level. So when you're talking about young kids playing tackle football, that's where it's in decline. It's actually the numbers in Utah for high school football are up, and they always. And I think they had like slight little dip, like by 10 one year, but they're up.
That expresses a concern for the really young kids, but in high school, it's still growing.
So I think it's parents saying, "I don't want my kid playing tackle football at 7, 8, 9, but you know, once they hit 6th, 7th, 8th grade, maybe I'll let them play tackle football." So, so that's where that, and part of that is they feel like they have to get into tackle football at least by the 6th grade if they're going to have a chance of making a high school team. And so that which is a whole nother discussion on how we could remedy that problem. But I wanted to point out, because of your last point, that high school trainers are not required in high schools. So you have a deal with University of Utah, but I would suggest that there should be someone on your staff and at every high school in this state who can make that medical call and overrule your coach, who is not beholden to the coach, right? So if I know from covering sports, if you have a great coach, a winning coach, a popular coach, he's like a king. Whatever he says goes. It's usually he, and once in a while she. But so I think that decision cannot be to the coach. It has to come from a medical personnel.
Could you do that?
Yeah, and I would welcome any principals of any of our surrounding high schools to give me a call and talk about how we were able to make that happen. And I mean, we really have this independent voice that is the voice of reason when it comes to if a player goes back on the field or not.
You can actually look this up, though, and you can see there's a red dot for schools that don't have an athletic trainer, even part-time or on a case-by-case basis, and it's most schools in this state. And so and you're talking about football, so I'm guessing most people will try to get a trainer at a football game, but your girls are playing soccer and basketball and running cross country or playing the club sports of lacrosse with no trainer. And they don't see a trainer unless their parents take them to a doctor later.
We talked about with TJ Abraham a bill in New York that would ban tackle football for kids who are 12 and under. There's a bill in the works in Massachusetts right now prohibits tackling through 7th grade. Could something like that happen here? And what do you think about, because, you know, that question comes up about who's supposed to make this decision. Do you need legislation or do you put it in the hands of educators? Do you put it in the hands of parents? What do you think?
I think if you look at it as a public health issue, then you could say something like that could be an issue here. I don't see it happening here. We're too conservative. You know, I grew up in Alaska, libertarian leaning, and I always cringe when you talk about things being made illegal. But I do think if you look at it as a public health issue where I want my kid not to play tackle football until 8th grade, but I feel the social pressure that comes with having my kid involved in a tackle football program because I want him to make a high school team. I love football. I would definitely let my kid play football. But I'm telling you what, I know where the good coaches are and where the bad coaches are, and I wouldn't let my kid. And it's not just about it being able to diagnose or handle a concussion appropriately. There are a whole host of health reasons that you want to make sure your coach knows what he or she is doing. And also, I think there are some coaches who, they call them old school coaches, I call them abusive coaches, who need to come into this century and understand the way in which you motivate people does not have to leave them emotionally scarred for the rest of their
lives.
Those
are the suck it up kid coaches,
yes.
Right? Yeah.
Can I throw this out there, too? We have a great support in the UHSAA. I met with them yesterday in looking for innovative solutions as we move forward with our program. And what we were able to do yesterday and through the Board of Trustees, myself and our athletic director presented to them. And we are going independent next year. So we're able to control our schedule and be able to line up with different high schools that have relatively the same size of team. And I think this is a great way to move forward to help rebuild a team and be able to give the support to the freshmen and sophomores. So they're playing against teams with 35 kids or 40 kids. And what we're seeing in that is it's not just a 1A, 2A, 3A issue. There are 6A teams that have 35 players on their team that are also looking for that type of support. So I think us looking forward with some innovative solutions will help those kids have
a much
better
experience.
Well, that
actually happened at Ogden High. Ogden did that. Mm-hmm. They went into – because they couldn't build their program. Mm-hmm. They couldn't get enough kids. And no one wants to go – football is the only sport where you know going into it you're going to suffer a tremendous amount of physical pain if you don't have the numbers.
So it sounds like there's a conversation that's being had that wasn't there before. We're almost out of time, but Amy, let me ask you just quickly, what does the future of football look like in 10 years, do you think? High school football.
I think it looks more co-ed. I think it looks more – because I think girls are playing – I mean, the fastest growing sport for women is wrestling. Wrestling's probably going to be sanctioned in the next year or two for women.
But football is not going away, is what you're saying.
It's not going away. I think it's going to change and evolve, and it's going to be less this macho, completely male-dominated thing. But the warrior aspect of it will remain, but I think you have to take the critical decisions. I do think you're going to see just a continued decline in tackle football amongst the youngest ages.
Quick word.
Yeah, I would say that we need to do everything we can to educate our coaches and continue to be able to make student-driven decisions, make those the first priority.
It's Patrick Lambert, principal of Judge Memorial Catholic High School. Thanks for coming in.
My absolute pleasure. Thank you.
And Amy Donaldson of the Deseret News. Thank you. Good to see you.
Thanks.
Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. As always, we want to hear from you. We're on Twitter at Radio West. Thanks to our intern, Natu Twe, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard, by Ali Vallarta, and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer, and I'm Doug Fabrizio.